The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra Christmas Special, and what a festive weekend for Liverpool, becoming champions of the world in Qatar while their closest rivals get a beating from Manchester City. Elsewhere, the Nigel Pearson bounce begins with a win over mid-table Manchester United. Chelsea have a VAR-heavy win at Spurs, for whom Paulo Gazzaniga goes full and unexpectedly Karate Kid. Almiron scores, Wolves rob Norwich, and Bournemouth and Burnley should be ashamed of themselves for serving up that rubbish. We'll ask AFTV what is it good for, we'll do the Football League Europe, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Christmas Special. On the pod today, Flo Lloyd-Hughes, nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Max.
Jonathan Wilson, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Lars Sivertsen, hello.
Slightly discombobulated, I am, Max.
Okay, it is 7:10 on Sunday evening.
That's not why I'm discombobulated.
Oh, right, yes, you're in Barry's
chair.
I'm
in the wrong chair.
All right, you're in Barry's chair.
Well, that's not just Barry's, but it's the first ever pod outside of my usual chair.
Well, what, you
and
think,
I've said
you
this
think,
so many
on,
times.
You think you're so established you have
no,
a Lars
I'm,
chair?
No. I'm just saying I've sat in the same place every time I've been in. I'm okay. Not saying that's the Lars chair. There's a big difference.
Is it this chair? Because I've also sat in this chair.
No, it's the one Wilson's in.
Okay, no, you're in my chair.
No.
So flows just, it with, without this saying, sounding like Goldilocks and the Three Bears.
What I'm saying
Wilson's
is, I'm no,
chair.
I'm no James Milner. Like, I'm not good at playing out of position.
Well, let's see how it works. Thomas begins with, "What is Lars having for Christmas dinner?"
I don't know yet. These decisions I leave to the good Mrs. Herndorf.
Are you going to just eat leftovers from that? Will it be
that's very possible.
A Szechuan chicken?
The thing about Szechuan chicken is a very misunderstood dish, because what you get at like your normal Chinese restaurant bears very little resemblance to actual food from Szechuan, which is very good.
Okay, that was the I'm sort of
saying,
interesting
you,
detail
you,
I was really looking
ask,
for there.
Ask and you shall receive.
Actually a book just come out this Christmas by somebody called Fuchsia Dunlop, who I was at a dinner party with once.
You made that up.
Expert in, no, she's an expert in Szechuan cuisine.
Yeah. Right.
Should we there get on with the...
There is
no,
one Lars, in no,
Road
no,
where they
come
do
on.
Sort of chili, the sort of fish thing. Sorry.
That's okay. You can finish the sentence.
Am I allowed?
Yes.
And they do a sort of fish and chili oil thing that's pretty amazing. If you get to a proper Szechuan restaurant, I do recommend it.
Excellent. That might be in the pod. right. let's start with Liverpool in Qatar then. Liverpool won Flamengo 0 after extra time, Bobby Firmino. Liverpool become the second English side to win the FIFA Club World Cup. Klopp said the boys dug in again and massively put in a performance. At the moment, we pass test after test after test. Flo, he's right, isn't it? They do keep doing that, not necessarily convincingly, but it's kind of stunning how they can just keep winning football matches.
Yeah, I think everything is sort of going in the direction of Liverpool winning the Premier League this year. Everything is kind of coming together, things are going their way. It's interesting to see them play against other teams out of Europe. That's quite nice, a bit different. Because we're so used to seeing them have to play Man City or have to play Tottenham and it shoved down our throats, or losing to Napoli or whoever it may be. So it was quite nice to see them play a slightly different team.
Did they deserve it, Jonathan? And did we, I probably did, underestimate Flamengo and probably Monterrey as well. I sort of presumed once they were taking it seriously that they would just win it quite easily.
Yeah, Flamengo were better than I was expecting, actually. Flamengo in the Libertadores final were really rattled by River Plate pressing them. I think their success in Brazil this season has come largely from the fact that they're playing a European style. They have been pressing. And other teams aren't doing that back to them. I sort of expected Liverpool, as soon as they began to press, they sort of roll over them in the way that River Plate sort of dominated the first sort of 70 minutes of that Libertadores final. And that didn't happen. And I think what you often see in the Club World Cup is European teams are fitter. And that probably was an issue by the end. But again, it wasn't as big an issue as it has been in the past. So I think what Jorge Jesus has done with Flamengo is remarkable. And although they lost, Flamengo are probably the best. You know, it's been the best display put on by Libertadores winning at the Club World Cup since, was it Corinthians who won it, beating Chelsea?
That's the one I was thinking of.
Yes, they did very well.
Lars,
yep.
We don't take it that seriously here, this competition. Should we, or does it matter?
I think I like the concept. I'm big on the sort of meritocracy of football. You know, you can start a team wherever. If you become the best team in your country, you play in the European tournaments. And then it is entirely logical that there should be a next tier of sort of mixing the champions from the various parts of the world. It's just, it feels like a continent that's never been done. It feels like a contest that's never been done right. It comes... in the middle of the season for us, at least. That's a little bit sort of a Europe-centric way of looking at it, but I mean, we're in Europe, so here we go. It comes in the middle of the season for us. It's a very small and quick tournament. It's like you play two games and then you're out of there. I feel like if they expanded it a little bit, most of the time expanding tournaments is the wrong answer because it brings just more games for the wrong reasons. But I feel like if you made this bigger somehow, maybe had the finalists from the continental competition or something and made it a bigger deal, perhaps put it somewhere more conveniently in the calendar, if there is such a thing.
That's something say is there
I do believe there could be a good Club World Cup
that is what's happening in 2021.
Maybe that's what they end up doing. I just have no trust in them figuring out a sensible way of doing it. But anyway, I also watched Flamengo in the Libertadores final. They weren't very good, and I watched Flamengo against Al Hilal in the semis, where they were terrible in the first half. I mean, I feel bad now because I tweeted that their performance could be very plausibly improved if players were replaced with actual Flamingos, because they were just so, yeah, against Sebastian Giovinco's Al Hilal, they were so bad. But they really turned up in this game, I thought, and did give Liverpool some problems. I mean, you did see all the sort of Jorge Jesus pressing stuff. So in the end, it wasn't actually that straightforward.
Were you proud of that Flamengo? I mean, proud enough to repeat it on a podcast?
Oh, yes.
How many retweets and likes did you get?
Oh, no, some.
For that one.
Some. I'll look it up for you, Max.
Please.
Since you ask.
Yeah, I do.
Or are you going to repeat your thing of asking me questions and then making fun of me for answering the questions?
Maybe.
Because that seems to happen a lot.
Three different species of flamingos.
Is that right?
Mm. What kind of sound do they make?
No.
Yeah,
I got six retweets and 50 likes. I'll take that. It's not okay. Good. It's not good, sounds, but, you know, I'll take it.
Yeah. Easy audience, yours. Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah, not up to Max's standards, clearly.
I was chatting to Tim Vickery on Saturday about this, and he was saying that it was really important for Roberto Firmino because he obviously is a Brazilian and he cares about the tournament, and he is seen as a... Although he is starting up front for Brazil, he's not been brilliant for them, and it would have mattered a lot to him. You could tell when the final whistle went, though, that the players didn't celebrate in the same way as... winning a tournament that players who really care about the game they're playing in celebrate. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think the actual trophy lifting segment, they celebrated quite hard. But maybe the initial final whistle, not so much.
Bev says, is Liverpool's trophy lift being cut off for Michael McIntyre more evidence that the game is in fact gone?
Maybe. But like on the subject of the Brazilian teams, I mean, if you are a Brazilian football fan and you're a fan of a domestic team, or same in Argentina, you're from a country that has just an immense footballing pedigree, of course, but you see every single good player that your country churn out ever move to Europe. If that is your context, then I think your one chance at pitting your team against a European team will surely matter to you quite a lot. In a way, it probably won't for Liverpool, who have to go to Qatar when they don't really want to in the middle of the season. It makes sense that for them it would matter more.
So do you... It's interesting, isn't it? I guess there's another reason that we don't massively care about this is because English teams don't win the Champions League every year, and so we are just not used to this tournament. And I suppose Spanish teams, Spain has a better link with South America, or a more obvious link with South America.
Maybe, but I just think more fundamentally, I think there's Champions League is clearly a harder thing to win.
Mm-hmm.
There's more good teams than Champions League. The problem for European teams, and the last decade, maybe for longer than that. You get embarrassed by a team who is weaker and has fewer resources than you do. The upside is, well done, you've beaten a load of teams you expected to beat anyway. So I sort of get why it sort of feels an imposition for European teams. Maybe Real Madrid are different because they've got such a sort of... Their whole outlook is sort of this kind of, collecting sort of global silverware.
But anyway, well done to Liverpool for winning the Club World Cup. They play Leicester at 8 p.m. on Boxing Day. We'll do City-Leicester in just a second. We'll go to Spurs-Chelsea, the game we just all watched together, and we'll start on the pitch before we talk about matters off the pitch that are pretty serious. But on the pitch, Tom says, why did Jonathan Wilson get Chelsea Spurs so wrong in the build-up? Chelsea Stuff says, interested in how Jonathan contrives to argue that Chelsea's performance today demonstrates Lampard can't organise a midfield, especially if he can find a desperate way to relate to his playing days, like when Chelsea conceded 15 goals in 04-05. He's taken this to heart, hasn't he? Adam says, Wilson eating Lampard-flavoured humble pie, please. Off
that
you go.
Sounds awful.
Chelsea were very good today. Tottenham were awful and Chelsea were very good. I was wrong.
Is it that simple? Why were they... do you think they just played better, or did Lampard get it right tactically? No, I mean, play three at the back?
I don't think anybody expected them to go to the three at the back. So, you know, they went back to the old Antonio Conte system, the 3-4-2-1, which I think they'd only used at Wolves previously this season. And that Wolves game was an odd game in that... So nothing happened. I was covering that game. Nothing happened for the first sort of quarter of the match. Then Tomori banged one in from miles out. Suddenly Chelsea played brilliantly, and then they sort of buckled at the end and ended up winning it 5-2, but without really being convincing apart from sort of half an hour in the middle of it. But they did look a lot more solid today. And credit to Lampard for going back to that system. That I think, you know, I like that 3-4-2-1. I think, you know, having the two holding midfielders in front of the back three means you've got a really solid trapezoid base. And yeah, but equally, it can't be overlooked just how pitiful Tottenham were in that first half.
Why were they so pitiful? Their midfield is interesting if you play Dier and Sissoko. There's obviously
interesting is the word for it.
You've got Harry Winks, Tanguy Ndombele, yep, and Christian Eriksen sitting on the bench.
So you've made a decision there that you're not going to try to play your way anywhere, right? Because if you line up with Sissoko and Dier as your sort of double pivot, odds are you're not going to pass your way through the opponent, right? You've made a decision. And I always figured this whole mo midfield, mo problem thing, I guess the plan is to just go over them, just whack it long for Kane and get knockdowns to Dele Alli and Mora and so on. And you know, in theory, that's not a bad plan. I just thought the odd thing was then they weren't really doing that in the first half. We were watching it just now, and it feels weird watching Tottenham and thinking they should play more long balls, but the way they were lined up, they needed to whack it to Kane more often, I thought, and they just really struggled to create anything.
Quite often, pundits who aren't goalkeepers can get criticism for not really understanding the art of goalkeeping flow. I don't know if you know where I'm going here, but we sort of watched that Gazzaniga choice of just trying to decapitate Marcus Alonso instead of just catching the ball. And actually, when Anthony Taylor gave a free kick to Spurs, I wasn't convinced that was the wrong thing to do. Do you see what I mean? Because it was just so odd.
Yeah, the whole situation was a bit bizarre. When you saw the replay, you couldn't really think why has he given that as a free kick to Spurs? Because really, he's just gone full karate there and tried for no reason.
I mean, my first thought was, why is Paolo Gazzaniga doing that? Like, what's he do? What? I mean, I don't expect answer it.
It was just one of those moments where your brain leaves your body and your body just carries on moving, and he just tried to commit, I don't know what kind of crime, but yeah, it was not his best moment.
Did you not play a game on the pod earlier in the autumn where you asked Barry, is this or is this not a fish?
Yes, we did that, yes.
So what Spurs, I think, need to do with Gazzaniga, they need to sit him down and sort of show him situations and images in game where they're like, catch or kick opponent in the head. Like, some of these situations, you just go for the catch.
I mean, there was
There aren't many where kicking the opponent in the head is the way to go, but I mean, maybe there are some,
well,
I'm not sure.
If you're Manuel Neuer in a World Cup final kicking Gonzalo Higuain, apparently that's okay.
There was the Bravo Mane one, but two seasons ago, that obviously ended the way it did. So I guess there's some history there with goalkeepers maybe going and strikers going for the wrong option.
Can I just surprise no one by giving a shout out for a good VAR here?
Yes.
Because this is one of those where I guess the ref, I don't know how the ref missed it the first time. Maybe it's just so weird and outlandish that the ref just didn't process what had just happened. But he was bailed out.
I sort of forgive him for going, well, that can't just have happened.
Like, yeah. what was that? And it's hard to react, I guess. But yeah, he was bailed out by VAR because that would have been an extraordinary blunder if he hadn't given the...
To be fair to Gazzaniga, it did feel a bit like something Hugo Lloris might do. So in a sense, he was playing his role quite well.
The strange thing that happened, where, you know, we were sitting in the pub watching it and we were sort of thinking, oh, there must have been a back pass, but I don't remember.
Yeah, why is he not catching that? Why?
And so you're thinking, how is the... I can see how the ball might bounce that high from a headed back pass, But what kind of back pass is it? Oh, no, it's just Willian playing the ball over the top.
And then Davinson Sanchez, really not being subtle, by putting his head in his hands as Gazzaniga is flying through. Next question, and another VAR-based question, is what is Heung-min Son doing? I think in the pub, none of us thought it should have been a red card.
No, that's not true.
Okay, I'll take it back. In the pub, I thought, because I wanted Spurs to win, it wasn't a red card, but I can see why it was given. I know it's spoiling the football match shouldn't matter. I just was really frustrated. But he shouldn't have done it, right? I can see.
If you kick somebody in the chest or in the ribs,
whether you make contact,
it's a red card.
Yeah.
You know, it's, yeah, okay. And you can't suddenly start expecting people to ask, yeah, how hard did he kick him? Just don't do it. If he got a yellow card for it, nobody would have been that bothered, but... Yeah, technically, it's a red card.
It's the intent, isn't it? It is violent conduct at the end of the day, kicking someone.
And yes, Rudiger did probably make the most of it, but at the same time, I imagine being kicked in the ribs, no matter how gently it is probably pretty disconcerting.
True,
maybe,
but
quite sore.
He's not that kind of player, Jonathan, and he looks so sad.
I mean, I think he has a temper. I don't think he's a dirty player, and I maintain that I think the Andre Gomez thing was completely accidental, for all you weirdos on the internet out there. But he did get a straight red against Bournemouth for being wound up by Jefferson Lerma. Mm-hmm. I mean, he does have it in him for it to boil over a little bit, and I think he is only the second, according to a tweet I saw from someone credible, only the second player in the Premier League era to get 3 straight reds in a calendar year. Does anyone know the first one?
Well, if you're going to say Lee Catmull...
No, it's not.
Okay, Lee Catmull did get 3 reds in a calendar year, but they were all for the second yellows.
Is it someone we would expect to have got?
Probably not.
Oh, really? How about if it's someone we wouldn't expect... in the Premier League, so since 1990,
give us a year. Give us a year for it.
1997.
Darren Barnard. Is it a well-known footballer?
Yes.
Steve Bruce.
No.
Oh.
Give us a club.
Coventry City.
Theon Dublin.
Yes.
Right.
Really? So you wouldn't expect that.
No, you wouldn't. But he got angry with Robbie Savage once, didn't he?
Do you think this
happened
means
to all of us?
Do you think this means sometime in the future, Son Heung-min will be very excited about stairs going all the way up to the bedrooms?
Well, if he becomes the new presenter of Homes Under the Hammer, I will be more than happy. Frankly,
I think he could do that. He has charisma.
He does. We should also criticise Serge Aurier, but praise Willian for the first goal, Jonathan, because he takes that beautifully, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. I mean, Aurier clearly should get out to him quicker. But given the opportunity, Willian takes it brilliantly. You know, cuts in the box, and it's a fantastic finish.
And loath as I am to do exactly what I'm about to do, Flo, which is a comparison of Harry Kane and Tammy Abraham, but if you only watched that game of football, you would presumably think that Abraham was a much better footballer.
I think that's a bit harsh. I mean, you've got to look at the supply to Kane, and there wasn't very much of it. Chelsea at the moment have more players who can kind of sum things up out of nowhere and create opportunities and create chances. Eriksen came on, didn't really do anything. Dele Alli didn't really have an impact either. Son got sent off. All Spurs' impact players are really failing to produce what they really rely on as a unit. And Chelsea's youngsters and Willian, who is turning back the clock, although maybe that's harsh, he's only 31, but he's having a really, really good season. You know, they're just producing things when they need to, and when they're lacking elsewhere, they've got attacking talent who can create things. Spurs don't have any of that at the moment.
No. But Abraham did cause Alderweireld, who's just signed that new contract, a torrid time, didn't he?
Yes.
He's good. He's a good footballer, Tammy Abraham.
Thanks so much for that insight.
Cutting-edge insight.
On Sky, the humble Jose Mourinho said that he hopes Antonio Rudiger gets an X-ray on his broken ribs. But he got it wrong, Jose, didn't he, really, in that game?
Well, I think he got that comment wrong as well, given this is a player who, you know, appears to have been racially abused.
Well,
it's not the, you know, not the cleverest thing to do to kind of start blaming him.
Now, anti-racism protocols used by the stadium announcer on 2 occasions, apparently, in the 75th and the 83rd minute, said racist behaviour from supporters is interfering with the game. Please remember that in football there is no place for racism. That came after Anthony Taylor had been told by Cesar Azpilicueta what Antonio Rudiger had said to him, and they both, you could see soon after Son had been sent off, Rudiger sort of saying, listen, I've been racially abused, or I've had a monkey chant aimed at me. Cesar Azpilicueta after the game said, we've been told to report any racist abuse to the referee. Tony told me there had been some racist songs towards him, so I told the referee straight away, left it to him to do his job. We're very concerned and very aware of this behaviour, and altogether we need to stop it. It's an issue in life, not only in football. At the time of recording, Spurs haven't released a statement. If they do while we're recording, we will obviously read it out. Finnegan says, why wasn't the match stopped at Tottenham after the third PA announcement? We think there were only two, but there may have been three. Were they repeat offences, or were these reminders from the stadium PA? You've been looking, Lars, at the FIFA protocol is, and whether we've adopted it.
Yeah, I wasn't there, so I can't speak to that really, but it's an odd one. The famous three-step protocol that we had a lot of talk about in the international on the international scene. FIFA they've urged all federations to adopt this protocol. Now, whether the Premier League has officially done so, I'm not aware. I don't think so. And the idea in the three-step protocol is certainly that you get one warning over the tannoy. If it happens again, the player should be taken off for a prolonged period of time, maybe to cool things down, but also to give stewards and security time to identify and get rid of the culprits, presumably. And then if they come out and the game continues and it happens again, the game should be abandoned. And listen, we can discuss whether or not this is the best way of going about things, but I think it's probably more effective than having repeated tannoy announcements, I guess, because I don't think that's going to do a lot.
Yeah, there's a problem in football, there's a problem outside of football. It's very easy for football to say, oh, this is a societal problem, football also has to put its own house in order. But it's very hard to put its own house in order when, you know, the wider world also has that problem.
I think it's especially problematic in football because we have a history of hostility associated with the game, and although there's lots of racist incidents happening in society, there's this separation of real life that occurs when people enter a football stadium, and there is this sort of diminished responsibility in a way. And we saw that, you know, with the incident with Spurs last year when a fan threw a banana at Aubameyang and he said, you know, I'm not a racist guy. And it's this sense of kind of mob mentality of what happens in this moment in these four walls isn't real life.
Leave your moral code at the door.
Exactly. And something that you probably wouldn't necessarily do to someone on the street, you think is perfectly viable in a football stadium. Now, lots of people would probably still do that in the street and probably wouldn't care. But there is this sense of, you know, morality doesn't always exist in a football stadium, and it's something that is really toxic and needs sorting out, but it doesn't seem to go away, and it won't go away, as Jonathan said, as long as it still exists outside of football, it won't disappear anytime soon.
There's an oddity. I mean, I think you're absolutely right, but there's an oddity. You're actually more likely to get into trouble for racist behaviour in a football stadium than outside.
So you're more likely to act like that and more likely to get in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, there's CCTV everywhere, right?
The guy who got caught on camera at the Manchester derby, you know, appears to have paid a pretty heavy price for it.
Do you think, and I've had this argument on the radio before about kind of what is the acceptable level of abuse? Clearly, racism isn't acceptable.
Well, there's no acceptable level, but there's there has to be proportionality about your response to it. There's a case in cricket, I don't know how long ago, 10, 15 years ago, when Chris Cairns, a New Zealand all-rounder, his sister was killed in a train crash. Mm-hmm. And as he walked out to bat, the slip cord and made train noises at him. Now, that is pretty much as horrific as abuse comes. But it's very hard to enshrine in sort of a code of conduct of a game and the laws of a game legislation against stuff that's just really horrible. You can enshrine stuff about race or... Sure. Your homophobia, or, you know, so in a sense that it is something we can tackle and therefore we should.
But irrationally, Spurs fans should be able to boo Antonio Rudiger because they think he's got some sense. Should be able to boo and boo and boo, and absolutely, that should be fine, right?
It is fine, because I mean, that's a way that you kind of the way sort of fans of the society of football can, to an extent, sort of regulate behaviour. Mm. That if somebody does something outside the bounds of acceptable behaviour, you can boo them, you can abuse them for that. But clearly there is a line beyond which that cannot go.
Yeah, and I think that abuse just brings more abuse. Do you know what I mean? When you set a standard of this is the way it's going to be and we're going to abuse people, then you're just inviting more abuse, whatever levels that might be. And it takes so long to try and minimise certain levels or certain insults or certain isms that really it's so difficult to say, oh, well, this is worse than the other.
As I said, if Spurs do make a statement, we will, of course, read it out. And we are definitely planning to do another special in the new year. Chelsea's next game is against Southampton at 3 p.m. on Boxing Day. Spurs play Brighton 12:30 on Boxing Day. On Saturday, it was announced the sad news that former Spurs and more well-known as former West Ham player and England player and World Cup winner, of course, Martin Peters, died at the age of 76. He scored in the World Cup final, was Britain's first ever £200,000 player after his move from West Ham to Spurs in 1970. Sir Geoff Hurst wrote, "Today's a very sad day for football and for me personally. Martin Peters was one of the all-time greats, a close friend and colleague of mine for an excess of 50 years, a fellow World Cup final goal scorer and my West Ham partner for years, along with Bobby Moore. Rest in peace, old friends." Interestingly, his debut was just months before the World Cup. It's in May of 1966. And I always kind of presumed that that side had been together for so long, and he came in very late. And
but I mean, that story is, you know, is you see the genius of Ramsey with that, that he decided there was a game in December 65, England beat Spain, I think 2-0 in Spain, and played brilliantly, playing without wingers, playing for sort of a 4-4-2, they end up winning the World Cup with. And Ramsey then hid it away because he didn't want anybody to realise. And then they went to Poland, and he read out the team in the dressing room sort of an hour before kickoff. And he said, "And number 11, and then paused in a very un-Ramsey-like way, you know, for dramatic effect. Said, "Number 11, Martin Peters." And there's a sort of shock. And that was him sort of saying, "This is how we're gonna set out to win the World Cup." And then he went back, the group games. I think Peters played in
he
the
didn't,
second,
didn't play the first game against
played the
Europe,
second
Europe,
two
yeah.
group games, but they were playing a 4-3-3. And then they go to the 4-4-2 for the game against Argentina in the quarterfinal. And so that's Ramsey's kind of not just working out a way that he's going to play a totally different style, a totally different system to win the World Cup, but also his cleverness in disguising that fact. And Peters was central to how they played, playing in that sort of left-sided role, not as advanced as a winger, but also offering a creative threat from there. And everybody who played with him said he was one of the most intelligent players that they ever played with. So, yeah, absolutely central to England's World Cup.
And he was known for, he was called the Ghost, because in a sort of modern context, like Frank Lampard, I guess, he ghosted into the box late to score goals.
Yeah, because his starting position was much deeper than would be traditional for, or would be expected for a player in that sort of role.
And apparently for some time, that was known as a Martin Peters, that goal, sort of arriving late and scoring, it was named after him. He ended up playing non-league football for Goulston-on-Sea in East Anglia, which is extraordinary. You know, that is like England beating Croatia in the semi-final, Croatia not getting tired, winning the World Cup, and then Raheem Sterling playing for, I don't know, Tooting and Mitcham in 2032. You know, it just shows you how sort of wildly football has changed.
Well, the fact that, you know, Geoff Hurst had to make a living as an insurance salesman after winning the World Cup. I mean, a man who's got a hat-trick in the World Cup final, and yet he has to make a living selling insurance.
Mike Calvin tweeting, "Another player from that generation taken by dementia, each case a private tragedy, given collective relevance by the campaign inspired by Dawn Astell." We, of course, send our best wishes to the family and friends of Martin Peters. Back to the football, Manchester City 3, Leicester City 1. Was this a footballing lesson for Leicester City, Lars Ivertsen?
Listen, Man City are still an amazing team, and we look at, so you're going to get annoyed with me, but if you look at the underlying numbers, they've produced a bunch of chances and they should have scored more goals. And there have been games where they've been slightly ineffective. Their pressing maybe hasn't been quite as effective this season as before, but when they're on their game, they're still every bit as good as they were in the last couple of years when they've accumulated 198 points over two seasons, which is completely unprecedented in this league. So going to that ground and getting tongued, it's no shame in it whatsoever, for my money.
Riyad Mahrez and Kevin De Bruyne were sensational in that game. Flo, how would you stop them if they're playing like that?
It's hard to, and I think it just shows the gap. Although, you know, Leicester are doing so well this season and are still second in the table, it just shows the gap in kind of the haves and the have-nots. You know, Man City still have such an incredible squad. The depth in that squad, maybe bar the defence, is so good. And when you put that up against what Rodgers has put together in that back four, which is still decent, but can't cope with that. And I mean, Soyuncu, who's had a pretty decent season, really couldn't cope whatsoever. He was just looked like a lost man.
That whole side of a lesser defence was totally destroyed by De Bruyne. That he took up this much more advanced position than he normally would do. Although he was actually very advanced against Arsenal as well, so I don't know if that's a new thing that City are doing. And he was in, so he was almost as an old-fashioned inside right, that he was too far to Ndidi's left for Ndidi to pick him up. He was too far, he was too deep for Soyuncu to pick up. So Chilwell ends up picking him up.
And he's already getting a runaround from Mahrez.
Which leaves
Chilwell,
Mahrez free.
Yeah.
So you saw, it was three or four times in the first half hour, these sort of big booming crossfield balls from Benjamin Mendy to Mahrez. He's in sort of 30 yards of space. And so even though Chilwell can see the ball, and the ball obviously takes 4 or 5 seconds, whatever, to get over the pitch, he's still having to close down 30 yards because he's been following De Bruyne. So I think the only way you can this is not the solution, but it's a beginning to a solution, is you have to play two holding midfielders and one of them has to pick up De Bruyne if he's going to play that high up.
Which is interesting, because we often hear talk of how Guardiola has his way and he doesn't change for anyone. This is completely untrue. I mean, he changes the structure of the team a lot. And this is an example of a sort of small little positional change that made it just really bad for Leicester. Because, yeah, Chilwell ends up in a position where he has to either leave De Bruyne in loads of space or leave Mahrez in loads of space. And for a left-back, that's not a good place to be. Like, there's no good solution there.
So should Rodgers have done something different?
I wonder, if you tell... was Ayoze Perez or Harvey or Barnes to come deep? I mean, that's not ideal. Maybe one of the three central midfielders, like Wilson says, maybe tell Tielemans to hang back more than he would normally to pick that up. That's not his game instinctively, but you have to adjust somehow to it.
Yeah, I mean, the problem for Rodgers, the difficulty is that Leicester's set up, that when they've been at their best seasons, they have 4-1-4-1, and the creativity that attacking four is really exciting. That's been what's driven them forward. So if you then go to City and you decide to change that and change the structure of a team to bring in Albright and whoever to play deeper, you then start thinking, well, is he betraying his principles? Is he betraying what's made them second in the league? But then, yeah, they do that, and yeah, it's by half time when Rodgers began to adjust, we're already 2-1 down, it's too late.
Another challenge here is, as we do think of Leicester City as a counter-attacking team, because they are very dangerous on the break, but actually,
7 counter-attacking goals a season, more indeed than anybody else in the Premier League.
But actually,
thank you, Johnny Five.
But actually, the way they've been playing this season, they have been better than almost anyone else in limiting the opponent's ability to build up play, because they press quite high, quite a lot, quite efficiently. If you look at a great number that I love, that's a passes allowed per defensive action in the opposition half, which is basically how many passes you allow the opponents to play in their own half before you either press them or tackle them or something. Leicester's actually got the lowest number there of anyone in the league. I mean, more so even than City. They basically, under Rodgers, they don't let anyone settle. They press high. But the thing is, that is a really dangerous way to play in City. Is an almost impossible way of playing in City, because they're so good you end up being played deep most of the time anyway. So what Leicester probably couldn't do as readily would be what United did, which sat back and pressed the space, have Scott McTominay running around kicking everyone and just hit them on the break. They're actually, even though they are a good counter-attacking team, they're not really set up to do that.
Manchester City have scored 841 Premier League goals in the 2010s. And here they all are. The most by an English top flight side over a decade since the 50s. So well done to them. We should mention Jamie Vardy's goal, which was a great finish and an unbelievable pass from Harvey Barnes. And he's got 17 this season. I think he got 24 in the league in the year they won the league.
So he's a phenomenon. If you'd put a bet on him being top scorer this season, you'd be very clever.
Have you done that?
I did that.
What's Pep been saying, Jonathan?
Yeah, he's... it was extraordinary, really, given that they played so well. They won the game. They've closed the gap on Liverpool to 11 points, having played a game more. But City apparently have made repeated complaints to the Premier League about the schedule over Christmas, that they and Wolves are the only two teams going to have to play 4 games in 8 days, because they play on the 27th, not the 26th. They play against each other again, City v Wolves, on the 27th. Guardiola said he'd written a letter to the FA.
Right.
He did his sort of sarcastic, passive-aggressive thing of, I want to say thank you for that. So he was really sort of oddly chippy. I mean, I know he's a kind of characteristically chippy man, but even by his standards, this was very chippy. And then offered the very slightest opportunity by a journalist question about, you've been playing catch-up since the Tottenham game, the second game of the season when they were denied that last-minute winner by the Laporte handball. And he started moaning about VAR and everything goes against them this season. So, I don't know, there's an odd paranoia about Guardiola at the moment, which I would suggest makes more likely those rumours that... makes more likely to be true, those rumours that he may be eyeing the exit in the summer.
Before we finish part one, Spurs have released a statement on what happened at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. It says, "We are now conducting a thorough investigation, which will include liaising with Chelsea and their players for their observations. Any form of racism is completely unacceptable. It will not be tolerated in our stadium. We take any such allegations extremely seriously and shall take the strongest possible action against any individual found to be behaving in such a way, including stadium bans." And that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at Vicarage Road. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Jonathan Wilson, part two is sponsored by what red wine is that?
It's a Chateau Marsac Seguino,
right?
Which is a 2015 Medoc.
Oh, thanks so much. Very kind of you for bringing
well,
me in.
Well, thank you for the champagne.
That's total. But well, thanks to the Totally Football Show.
Oh, yeah, I actually paid for mine. I didn't, actually. This is a gift from my financial advisor on injuries to the independent journalist Miguel Delaney.
Is that right? Yeah. Has Delaney got enough money for a financial advisor?
Apparently, yeah.
Well, that's
enough for the financial advisor to give me a crate of six of these. So.
Six?
Yeah. A crate?
Wow. Yeah.
Oh, you deal in crates when you're in your 40s.
Wow. I don't. right. Live shows, everybody. Thanks so much for coming to Leeds. We had a great time. We all did, except perhaps for a man called Dave. but thank you to his son for coming. 20th of January, we're at the Salis Benny Theatre in Brighton. Me, Barry, Ellis James, Nicky Bandini. 27th and 28th, we're in Dublin. Monday is me, Barry, Wilson, Ronay. Tuesday is me, Barry, Lars, Lou. And still a couple of tickets left for the 28th. 9th and 10th of March. On the 9th, we're at Glasgow University Debating Chambers, where we will do an interesting and academic debate. On the 10th, we're at the Pleasance in Edinburgh, where we'll do our sketch routine, don't we? Lars, you're there for both nights.
Yes.
Other
guests.
Can
do both serious debate and nonsense.
Other guests to be decided. Mm-hmm. How exciting. Right. Watford 2, Manchester United 0. The Nigel Pearson bounce. No shots on target in the first half. We can move on swiftly from that first half and go to the second half, where Watford scored two. Helped by Manchester United. Some could say it's almost as if David De Gea was pleased that Paolo Gazzaniga did that, so he did the worst bit of goalkeeping of the day. For me, Flo, that is the definition of the word flap.
Yeah, definitely. I think the most surprising thing is Watford didn't need to do anything differently. I've watched a lot of Watford this season and they were pretty much doing the same thing, but Man U just played it into their hands. Really, really stupid mistakes. Obviously, just a kind of moment of idiocy from De Gea, and he just wasn't concentrating. He was clearly onto the next part of his movement. And then that penalty was clearly a penalty as well. So
yes.
Watford didn't really need to work hard for their win. They played the same way they've been playing all season. And Man U just didn't really have much to answer for it.
I must... I spent quite a lot of the last pod talking about how good Aaron Wan-Bissaka is at tackling.
To be fair, it's the first one he's got wrong for 2 years.
Yeah, when things are going wrong, when United aren't having a good game, it doesn't help that De Gea throws one in and Wan-Bissaka does the one thing he's really good at badly. That sounds unnecessarily disparaging. I think he is a top-class defensive right back, but no, that wasn't good. I think this is, I mean, again, I feel like this hasn't taught us anything new about United. Great stat from Opta that in their last, they've won only one of their last 17 games in which they've had more than 50% of possession. I mean, that's damning. Like, there's no way they should be. And my problem is I struggle. There are one of three things, or probably a mix of the three things that are happening. Either there is no plan, or there is a plan that the players are unable to execute properly, or there is a plan that the coaching staff are unable to teach the players properly in the training ground, or probably a mix of all of the above. I think if your midfield is Fred and McTominay and you've got Lingard as a number 10, you'll probably always struggle against teams that sit deep. That's not a wealth of creativity and vision in that group. But when it keeps going wrong in just the same way through all of these games, it is impossible not to look at the coaching staff and whether they're preparing them and offering solutions.
It's always seemed like no plan to me. Always, ever since Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has been in charge, it always seems like no plan. I think he gives too much responsibility to the players and just sort of lets them do their thing. And there doesn't seem to be much leadership from him, not much of an idea of where this team is going or what he wants them to do, even in this moment. It's just very much a, well, let's see what happens. I'll pick these 11 players and they might do something.
Jack Book was making the point that United just reflect the opponent.
Mm. I've got that tweet in front of me, actually. Yeah. I thought it was really interesting. Manchester United seem to perfectly replicate the level of whoever they're playing. Good against Spurs, brilliant against City, routinely bad against the lesser sides. They are a chameleon team, he says, like a glitzier version of Slaven Bilic's West Ham.
Yes, I mean, if Barry really wanted to find himself, rather than spending a month going on India, he should have just played against Manchester United. And whatever Manchester United were, that's what he would.
It made me think of when I get in a taxi and my wife hates me for it, I turn into a Cockney within about 2 minutes. And when I'm hanging out with my friend Tom Swirling, who plays polo, I go incredibly, even saying the word polo, I go posh, right? I don't know if that's just, I'm a man of every people.
Well, how come you never sound Macca when you talk to me?
Because that
is it because you hate people from Sunderland?
Yes.
I know we've hardly talked about Jordan Henderson, a man so successful he's developed his own characteristic trophy lift. And literally nobody from Sunderland's ever said that before.
Well, I was watching Michael McIntyre, so...
And maybe part of the, guess, Man United chameleon-ness is that a word?
That definitely is now.
Maybe it's harsh, but maybe their players just get a bit more excited about playing City and playing Spurs and they're a bit more up for it than going to some of the other teams that are slightly lower down the table, and it's easier to sort of get them motivated to play better against those other players that are potentially on their level in some ways.
So they're still unbeaten against teams above them in the table this season. So clearly, if Manchester United want to win the league, what they have to do is go into administration, get a 25-point deduction, and then for a good sort of two-thirds of the season, the teams they're playing will be above them.
Yeah, that's true.
But I just don't agree with the chameleon theory. I just think there are very perfectly logical tactical reasons for this. In games where they can sit back and hit teams on the counter, they thrive. In games when it's on them to build their own play and break people down, they look like they don't know how to do
but
that.
When you that's how chameleons work.
Not at all. But from games,
have you never seen a chameleon in a zoo?
I don't think that's what they do, the chameleons. quick counterattack the other animals.
Chameleons, they don't actually adjust to their background at all. It's an entirely emotional reaction that changes the colours.
Is that right?
Yeah. So actually,
when Manchester United are bored, are they playing a team that aren't interested?
Which is the problem is that, if anything, the problem is that they're not adapting and changing their methodology according to their surroundings. They're quite the opposite of a chameleon.
Ah, right.
So that's why I then reply to Jack by saying it's more like the planet Solaris in the 1972 Tarkovsky classic, where the planet...
How many retweets did that get?
14.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's better than last. It's better than that flamingo
double
nonsense.
Double a flamingo.
Or was that likes, Wilson?
Oh, you might have been likes.
Oh,
yeah.
We got to investigate this. But just on a serious note, from games against Sheffield United, Newcastle United, Crystal Palace, Bournemouth, West Ham United, Watford, Aston Villa, Southampton and Everton, they've taken a total of 4 points. Like, you cannot do this. This is dreadful. And it is the same thing over and over again.
They're level on points now in Newcastle, which makes me wonder if they appointed the right club legend.
I think Paul Ince said, why don't they appoint Steve Bruce? And everyone went, don't be ridiculous. De La Feo was superb for Watford. It must be interesting. You don't agree with that?
He just always does this. He flatters to deceive.
Right.
I said I've been watching a lot of Watford this season. I've been working at a lot of their games. And he just always does the same thing. And today it paid off and he was on telly and it was great. But he can't be consistent. Even at the final whistle, he looked like he didn't really care that much, which if I was a Watford fan, I would be really frustrated about. And I know he's linked to a move to China anyway. So he might have one foot out the door. But He likes to, you know, do skills and show off, but actually, what does he achieve? And this season, he's had a lot of responsibility and hasn't delivered. Hopefully, this will, you know, kickstart their season. They've got a fairly decent run of games. They're going to play Sheffield United, Villa, Bournemouth, Wolves. So they can get a bit of a run going, but Deulofeu just frustrates me so much, and I would be really, really annoyed if I was a Watford fan, because he likes to turn up at the big occasions, yeah. But the rest of the season he just seems like he can't be arsed.
You know, him and Alain Saint-Maximin could start some sort of support group
with Adel Taarabt.
Yes. And then they all get signed by West Ham at some point.
I think that's unfair on Saint-Maximin, actually. I think Saint-Maximin, but even you're going to talk about numbers, which I may be as preferable to doing bird impressions, but but if you actually watch Newcastle, Saint-Maximin, yeah, he energises them. Even if he's running down blind alleys, they're energetic blind alleys that picks everybody up.
I do quite like him. I like his whole vibe. He's just, yeah.
He's what Newcastle need to kind of just get him going.
Your Ole Gunnar Solaris joke got 24 likes, which is half as many as my Flamengo joke. And can I just add that you have, like, I think you have four times as many followers as me, so percentage-wise it's not
great.
But
it's not a competition.
I do quite like Saint-Maximin as well, just without quoting numbers. I think he's fun.
I hate to get back to...
In fairness, doing a joke about 1972 Soviet cinema is a much higher tariff than a joke about pink birds.
Can I just...
You have a theme park dedicated to them in East Yorkshire.
Can I just thank people who are still listening to the world's biggest football podcast, and we really appreciate that you've stuck with us for this long. And if this is the time where you decide maybe I've had enough, it is Christmas, and I must say, Jonathan, your financial advisor has excellent taste.
Oh, it's lovely. It's
in
so
red
smooth.
Wine, really is. There was a stunning handball from Craig Cathcart in the 92nd minute, where he just basically just fell on the ball. He knew they were going to lose it, and he just caught it. I loved it. Colin says, should Manchester United use Sith science to clone Sir Alex Ferguson?
Is that technically a spoiler?
I don't think so. I watched it yesterday, and it didn't make me feel like it's a spoiler.
No, fair enough.
I mean, if you've seen one Star Wars...
Oh, so I think that's a spoiler about United winning 2-0. I'm losing 2-0. We've been talking about that for the last sort of 10 minutes.
I believe we're allowed to give out the results.
Get
on
your
the pod.
Snout out of the wine, Wilson, and pay attention.
If you don't want to know the results, stop listening now. It's what you do at the start of every podcast. If you have watched any Star Wars, you'll have a vague idea how this one goes. But it's really fun. Manchester United, Newcastle, 5:30 on Boxing Day. Sheffield United, Watford, 3 p.m. on Boxing Day. Let's rattle through the rest of the Premier League. Aston Villa 1, Southampton 3. Southampton move out of the relegation zone at Villa's expense. Danny Ings, first Southampton player to reach 10 goals before Christmas since James Beattie in 2002. He scored 11 this season. It's only him and Teemu Pukkiflo who've scored 9 or more from, quote, small teams. So vital to have someone down there who can actually score a goal.
Say that about goal scorers, and yet not at your second bottom, Sam at the fourth bottom.
Yeah.
Was he ever non-goal scoring forward like David McGoldrick?
I was going to say.
Or Joe Linton or Benteke, you're comfortable on the table.
So what's that about then? Because I was just using the cliche that if you're bad, but you can get a striker to score 20 odd goals, you might just survive. If you're good, you don't need a striker that can score goals.
Yeah, I mean, it's just about having a tactical system that works rather than lumping it to one bloke.
I knew you'd bring it back to tactics.
And if you want to read more about that, there's still time to buy my 2008
I'm always very happy to see players who've lost a lot of their careers to injury thrive. I mean, that's a lovely thing about Danny Ings. Also, he looks a lot like Welsh actor Richard Harrington, star of the moody crime drama Hinterland, which I'm sure Wilson have seen.
No, I haven't seen it.
It's quite good.
Is it worth my time?
It's a bit up and down. Some episodes are really good, some aren't, but the cinematography is quite good throughout. It looks very moody and sort of a good sort of rainy Wales. So if you're into the Scandi-Noir thing, it might do something for
you. Right. I'm the Walesy-Noir.
That Mallorca file thing that Nick Cohen was recommending. Dear, what's he
terrible,
on about?
Terrible. I'm on series one of Happy Valley, and that's pretty good, actually.
That is good.
It's really good, isn't it? Anyway, I was trying to talk about Aston Villa Southampton, and we did move it on to... I did mention Pukki as well. But we sort of do them together. That win for Southampton was... I mean, I don't know how it happened, because I don't know what to expect from Southampton ever, really.
But there is a thing. Teams who get absolutely hammered, and Watford may disprove this season, teams who kind of let in an 8 or a 9 tend not to go down.
Because it kind of galvanises everyone.
I think it's kind of... I don't want to go all Lars on you, I mean, that's literally the last thing I want to do. But you sort of, there's then a regression to the mean when you don't let in goals. Yeah, suddenly you're conceding, I don't know, Sunderland have three times in their history let in eight goals. They haven't been relegated in any of those three seasons.
Interesting.
Wigan weren't relegated, they let in nine. When Newcastle got beat 9-1 off Sunderland in 1908, they won the league.
Wow. I mean, Shane Long is vital for Danny Ings. You sort of think Shane Long, although he did celebrate when Ings scored, must have gone, oh, for goodness sake, I did all the work. You know, I outpaced my man, I took a good touch, and didn't quite get it wide enough, and then Danny Ings gets the goal. John McGinn has fractured his ankle, could be out for 3 months, which is a big blow for Aston Villa.
They and for Scotland for the playoffs for the Euros in March.
Oh, he's going to miss...
Well, probably. I mean, it's touch and go.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Villa play Norwich, Boxing Day, Chelsea play Southampton. We talked about that Norwich-Wolves game a bit. I had this theory that if Jose was really humble...
It's not.
Okay, but the Spurs should give the points that they rob from Wolves, and Wolves can give Norwich the points that they've robbed from Norwich. You know, it's the time of giving, isn't it? And you know, we're all trying to come together.
And Bournemouth and Burnley should just both say, look, the rest of the league, just take half our points. We don't deserve anything.
They should never play again, right?
On the subject of humble Mourinho, since we're in here now just after the game and the news are coming out, it's a quote from Mourinho after the game by top Tottenham reporter man Alistair Gold, who says, Mourinho said, "The first goal is a short corner with a big mistake. We know how to defend short corners. We train how to deal with short corners. The players involved in the short corner situation, we're not focused." So humble Mourinho, who's a team player and not throwing people under the bus, like the cracks are there.
Yeah, I mean, he's totally right. But
yeah, he is spot on, isn't he? But you make a good point. Do we think Norwich are doomed?
Well, it's interesting at the bottom. I mean, I don't say this because I have to go any hatred of Arsenal at all. You know, I like Arsenal. I go to Arsenal. Arsenal have the best press facilities in the country and therefore a good thing. But it will be quite funny if they got in a relegation battle. Mm. And you just sort of think, there's no really bad team this season. I mean, Watford might be, but yeah, they're showing signs of life under Nigel Pearce, and we know Nigel Pearce can do to teams. So it is a bit of a shame if Villa and Norwich end up getting cast adrift, because I just sort of dream of a situation where Arsenal lose a couple of games, a couple of teams at the bottom win a couple of games, and Arsenal look over their shoulder and are suddenly a point above the relegation zone, and a team of feckless children, which is what they've essentially got at the moment, that's not fair, feckless players and children, panics. Then a really big team suddenly is scrapping for its life.
And look, Norwich and Villa, Norwich and Villa are both good teams, right?
It does. I get this sense now that the Premier League is slowly descending into what the Championship is, which is teams that play well not being rewarded for that. And it's getting chaotic. The gap is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and it's really hard to determine which are the crap teams and which are the good teams. So and that's exactly what the Championship is.
You say descending, I say ascending.
I love the Championship. I've spent most of my life in that division, and it's crazy and it's amazing.
I dream of the Championship.
but yeah, Norwich play really nice football, yet they are where they are. And Southampton, who play pretty dreadful football, are looking like they could be going towards safety. It's just weird.
Let's go to Goodison. Everton 0, Arsenal 0. Tony Hodgson, the journalist, saying Ancelotti and Arteta both have proper jobs on here. This is by some distance the worst Premier League game I've seen all season. Absolute filth.
And yet just half an hour later
yeah, Bournemouth and Burnley did him a favour. Ancelotti and Arteta both in the stands. Listen, I mean, did anything happen in the match? Richard Jolly tweeting, Duncan Ferguson has substituted a substitute in 67% of his Premier League games as manager. Cenk Tosun came on in the 10th and came off late on, so not quite the same as the Moise Keane incident. It's actually the biggest story of this game, because we've kind of talked about Arteta and Ancelotti. I don't know if you think it is the biggest story, maybe it isn't, but those videos circulating on Twitter of Arsenal fans targeting Robbie Lyle from...
There's just no way that's the biggest story from any football game, though.
Do you think... I mean, I wonder if that's just been taken out of proportion. I think it's an interesting... It's an interesting moment in what is... Maybe it's a broadcasting conversation rather than a football conversation. But it's all part of this thing where... he was surrounded by Arsenal fans after the game. They sang on TV saying, "Arsenal fan TV, get out of our club." Robbie responded saying, "Fans trying to intimidate and bully other fans need to stop." I think it is interesting, Lars, because I think... You know, broadcasting is changing, and there are a lot. Every club has its own podcast, its own fan TV. It is a different style of broadcasting.
Yeah, I don't want to be dismissive about Arsenal Fan TV. That wasn't my point. My point is that if you like it, you should watch it. And if you don't like it, maybe don't be an ass towards the fella at games.
Yeah, no, no. I think you make a very sense.
See where we go with the discussion beyond that.
No, I
disagree, actually. I think, I mean, obviously that point is fundamentally true, but I think it is an interesting story. I mean, quite apart from anything else, it highlights the fact that fans are not a homogenous mass.
Yeah.
That there are factions among fans, and individual fans have individual views. And I think Arsenal Fan TV, as the most successful of that sort of fan-based YouTube channel phenomenon, they have been an interesting force, and they clearly were at the centre of the Wenger out protests, even if they were reflecting those views rather than necessarily promoting them, and sort of in a wider discussion of what media is and what it should be and what it can be in the internet age, I think it's a fascinating story. Yeah. Maybe not the football story, maybe it is a media story, but it is interesting. And obviously, you know, nobody should be intimidated at a game, nobody should be bullied at a game, but the question of whether Arsenal Fan TV and the way you suspect some of the people on that, because it became performative, the anger, and whether that then conditions attitudes, and it sort of created the conditions that now make it very difficult for Arsenal to play good football or play well. There's that sort of pressure at the Emirates all the time. I think that is a discussion worth having. To what extent does the medium shape the actuality?
And also, I presume none of you watch AFTV because surely you've got better things to do, right?
Yeah,
because
you're not also, Arsenal. Not necessarily better. If I was an Arsenal fan, maybe it would be really interesting.
Sure,
to me,
sure.
I'm pretty confident that the funny stuff I'm going to see anyway, right?
Well, that's the point. I imagine as a TV channel, having not watched it, is much more balanced than the 1 minute you see on social media. And actually, what's interesting is, and we don't do this as a pod, but lots of radio shows do this and TV shows, is you get a minute out of context, tweet it out, and then suddenly the bosses of those companies are more interested in make a minute that gets 1,000 retweets rather than make a 2-hour interesting program. I mean, that is also quite an interesting way that the media is going, not just in sport,
I guess. Yeah, you're right. That's a general media thing of trying to turn news into entertainment, and that creates a demand for sort of inflated extreme views, which get reactions, which get sort of clicks and generate revenue, which is troubling, right?
I also think, at the end of the day, these are people who felt like they haven't had a platform before, so they create their own platform, and sometimes that doesn't necessarily result in the best things. It's definitely created a bit of a division within that fan base, but like Jonathan said, those divisions already exist. But if people feel like their voices aren't being heard for whatever reason, then they want to, you know, create their own way to voice their opinion. And some of what Arsenal Fan TV has done is great. They've got a really diverse group of people. They also involve, you know, quite a lot of women in their content, and that's great, because lots of other people weren't doing that until they started doing it themselves. But at the same time, you know, they have also got, you know, some characters on there who sort of play up to being who they are and saying certain things. And that's probably, you know, created this kind of anger amongst the fan base. But what happened yesterday certainly, you know, wasn't okay. But I think it just speaks volumes for what's happening up and down, you know, football stadiums around the country, and what happened today at the Spurs stadium as well. There's just such a kind of atmosphere of negativity. And even if you follow the same team, you don't necessarily follow the same politics or believe in the same things. And it's so hard to kind of find a consensus at
sure,
all.
Sure. And I wonder with AFTV is there's a slight bit of the Coldplay effect, right? Where people liked it when it was new and different, and now it's popular. People don't like stuff because it's not cool to like stuff that's more popular, and whether there's also a bit of jealousy from some fans. I'm sure some people have some legitimate concerns about how it represents the club, but also if you are an away fan who has a proper job and then you've seen these guys who started this thing and now they don't have to do a proper job, they just get to talk about football, there might be an element of envy there.
Yeah, and I guess there's also what feels fresh. I mean, I think the point about giving fans a voice is a very apt one, that, you know, fans' voices previously would be through fanzines, and obviously a TV channel or, you know, a YouTube channel gives you a much more immediate hit of that. But the problem is, you know, the more extreme of you, the more it gets seen.
Yeah. But actually, what you want is, or I think what fans want, if you look at and people do it, you know, the Anfield rap, do it well. United We Stand, do it well. And
Fulhamish, not to mention.
Well, of
award
course.
Award-winning Fulhamish.
Producer Sammy. Who's
current producer Sammy.
Exactly. And they're really important because, you know, we'll get criticism from this pod because we haven't spent enough time talking about Southampton, for example. But we have to try and do as much as we can in a short amount of time. And we've probably gone on too long already. But you know, like we can't go into detail about everything. I think traditional broadcasters are nervous about them. I think, you know, when I was at Sky and you know, they were looking at YouTube and didn't really know how to deal with it, and they've tried to, and I understand that because they're all trying to fight for the same bit of the pie. But I think if done well, it can be a really positive thing and give fans a chance to say what they like. And to criticise those fans that intimidated Robbie Lyle. Like, if you are criticising someone for being negative and creating a poisonous atmosphere, don't criticise them by being negative and being poisonous.
I mean, and Robbie's actually a very good broadcaster.
Decent guy, yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't know him at all. I'm judging him purely by his broadcasting. But he's very good as an interviewer. He brings people out and encourages them to say what they think.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what big friend of the show and big Arsenal man Tim Stillman wrote on Twitter after the incident, saying, an Arsenal side managed by a club legend featuring a clutch of academy products are playing away from home, and the natural reaction is, of course, to start singing derogatory songs about a YouTube channel. Maybe it's time we owned our toxicity and appetite for divisiveness rather than laying it at the door of a fan channel.
Absolutely.
And there's a thing to be said there, I think.
I think Tim is absolutely spot on. Let's go to Newcastle 1, Crystal Palace 0. Miguel Almiron finally getting his first goal for Newcastle. He did a really nice interview with Louise Taylor, actually, saying, I'm desperate for the first goal. I can't wait for that moment. I'm not beating myself up about not actually scoring, but I do think the day when I get my first one, I will be very happy. Kieran says, Steve Bruce, Newcastle flying. Brucey only 3 points from Europe. Could they? Question mark.
Well, look, Steve Bruce, I think, is a better manager than people give him credit for. When he was at Sunderland, he actually did pretty well, and then got scuppered by Darren Bent getting sold to Aston Villa. And immediately after he was sold, Sunderland played the previous season's top six plus Stoke away, from which they got 1 point, and then everything went in the downward spiral after that. And people suddenly noticed he was a Geordie, and Steve Bruce started talking about how he was victimised by being a Geordie. He's a okay mid-table Premier League manager, and Newcastle an okay mid-table Premier League club. And, you know, I think most people who dealt with Steve Bruce like him. Mm. He's a likeable bloke. And, I'm very glad that they're doing okay.
I think the thing that people always criticise that whole situation for is about the fact that Bruce was given a massive budget to spend. And if you look at what he spent, then perhaps this is where Newcastle belong. But at the same time, it was a bit of a shit show that he inherited. And he's getting them
Well, I don't think he was given the money to spend. The money was spent. I'm not sure how much say he had and where it went.
Well, probably. I mean, it's probably spent above his head.
I mean,
but
that's
it was all about
signing.
Benitez.
I think we will learn a lot more about Joe Linton signing as time goes by.
But it was all about the fact that Benitez wasn't given the transfer budget, and
Bruce he was
came
given
along
a Brazilian centre forward he didn't want.
And now maybe things are finally connecting, but at the same time, he's still got Andy Carroll in the team, which just seems ridiculous.
Yeah, but he set up the goal, didn't he? And I mean, yeah. Carroll is
great assist as well.
What a great thing Andy Carroll is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he must give so much joy. Bruce said he hadn't heard a roar like it after Almiron broke his duck in front of the Gallagher. And they go to Manchester United on Boxing Day. Palace play West Ham.
Did he really say that?
That's what he said.
I mean, what about Longstaff's goal against United?
Well, there is that.
Everyone really likes Almiron. He's a good lad.
Yeah, he's a good lad, isn't he?
People like the Longstaffs as well.
When he was 15, the interview with Lewis Taylor said he almost gave up football and just took a job moving shopping trolleys. And so his parents said, come on, you've been released by one club, you can have another go. And there he is. Brighton 0, Sheffield United 1. Ollie McBurnie with the only goal of the match against his former manager, Graham Potter. What a scruff pot he is, Ollie. But it was... listen, he earned that goal. I mean, it was poor defending, wasn't it?
And he also scored the last winner by a home team against Sheffield United.
Is that right?
Yeah, I mean... I'd got the cadence of that sentence slightly wrong, but yes. you know what I mean.
I mean what you mean. Sheffield United unbeaten away.
So their last defeat was against Swansea, and he got the winner for Swansea.
Right, they're unbeaten in their opening nine away league matches, which is unbelievable. They
another,
do go
that,
to...
Did you see that great Richard Jolly stat?
No.
And another great Richard Jolly stat, that Sheffield United have lost fewer games in England this year than Barcelona.
Wow.
Because their only defeat was to Swansea.
That is tremendous, isn't it? David McGoldrick still can't score. Oh. Rounded the goalkeeper. I mean, I think when he scores, I will cry. He will be so happy. Like Almiron was happy. He'll be so happy that it'll just be such a wonderful moment. And actually, he didn't want to look at the crowd because they love him so much, the Sheffield United fans. They didn't even look upset with him. You know, we talked about toxicity in a football ground. They are so supportive. But sometimes seeing sort of that kind of supportive pity is almost worse.
Yeah.
And he would have liked some abuse.
But obviously he should have scored that. But he's done incredibly well to make the run, to kind of go around the keeper. And it's actually a slightly harder finish than I think
that
it looks.
That is true.
The ball's running away from goal. He's got to hook it back and he just doesn't get enough on it. But
yeah, you're right.
Obviously he should score. He's got...
Brighton play Spurs on Boxing Day and Sheffield United play Watford. Bournemouth 0, Burnley 1. In the Football League, Leeds lost their first game in 11 as they went down 2-1 to Fulham. At Craven Cottage, Jos Onuma with the winning goal, his first since joining the club in the summer. West Brom couldn't take full advantage. They drew 1-1 with playoff hopefuls Brentford at the Hawthorns. It means the Baggies are top at Christmas, 3 points clear of Leeds. Sheffield Wednesday are up to third after their 1-0 win over Bristol City. Barry Bannon with a late penalty. The Sheffield Wednesday centre forward Nuhu, Flo, have you seen a lot of it? I mean, he looks like he's in about my shape, which is amateur football, drinks a little bit too much and eats whatever they like. It's quite amazing, the timber on Nuhu.
I love that, and there's lots of players in the Championship like that.
Are there?
Yeah, loads.
Oh.
QPR centre-back Tony Leisner, another example. Naby Sarr, Charlton, he's carrying a little bit. It's great. You can fully function as a professional athlete in that league.
See,
and
I always
have a little
thought,
bit extra.
Are we fat-shaming Championship players?
No,
because I think it is different as a professional sports person that...
It's not fat shaming. It's strength. Mm.
It is strength.
Strength. Shaming.
On that note, Akin Fenwick got sent off, didn't he, at the weekend? We'll get on to League One in a second. Preston moved down to fifth after a goalless draw with Cardiff in the lunchtime kickoff on Saturday. Rocky day at the top of League One. Wickham and Ipswich lost to Oxford and Portsmouth, respectively. Akin Fenwick was sent off for Wickham. Ipswich's defeat means that Peterborough. Oh dear, what a terrible way for Christmas to start. We're able to climb into the top two after their goalless draw at Bristol Rovers. Tom says, please let Jonathan Wilson discuss the shit out of Sunderland going to their lowest position in their history.
Well, I mean, in fairness, they didn't have a game at the weekend because they were supposed to be playing Bury. So it's not entirely Sunderland's fault this time. But, I mean, it's a massive squad of very mediocre players managed by a mediocre manager with a mediocre board.
There's a running joke among QPR fans about Joel Lynch never having to play at Christmas, and he managed to carry that through with the fact that Sunderland's game was
Well, there's
postponed.
A former QPR player who described him as mentally the weakest player he's ever seen.
He's terrible. Oh, he's awful.
Oh, I feel sorry for this guy.
He's the one who I think on the QPR podcast I've described having brain farts the most amount of times.
Oh, but, you know, he must be good at other things.
No.
Okay. In League Two, the top two, Swindon and Exeter, both held by Forest Green and Walsall, respectively. Crewe move into third with a thumping 5-1 win away at Stevenage. Cambridge's attempt to overturn a 3-0 half-time deficit against Leyton Orient fell just short as they lost 3-2. Two red cards. The referee was Trevor Kettle. The game really did boil over.
God.
Tom got in touch.
No more making fun of my flamingo jokes after that.
Tom got in touch to ask if I'd mentioned Morecambe's ticker-tacker winning goal scored by John O'Sullivan, so I did. In Scotland, both the top 2-1. Celtic narrowly beat Aberdeen 2-1 to secure their 10th consecutive victory. Rangers stay 5 points behind after they convincingly beat Hibs 3-0 at Easter Road. Bit of trouble at that game. In the big match at the bottom of the league, Hamilton picked up their first win since September over fellow strugglers Hearts. Daniel Stendel has now lost his first three games in charge at Hearts, and they are 3 points adrift. That will do for part two. We'll round up Europe in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Thanks for sticking with us through the Christmas special. Feels like this pod has been about 2.5 hours long.
I'm so hungry. You've got no idea how hungry
We've not had dinner. It's 8:30. Spain now. It's currently 0-0 between Real Madrid and Athletic Bilbao. You'll know the score. We don't. Barcelona beat Alaves 4-1. Messi scoring his 50th of 2019. quite good. Suarez was involved. He's the number one, by the way, in the Guardian top 100 footballers. Go and look at it. I voted, and even I'm slightly annoyed by some of the positions of some of the players.
If I knew Marco Reus was going to end up where he ended up,
yeah,
I would have put him top just to try to move the needle a little bit, because that is a disgrace.
Where did he end up?
80th or something. Like, what are you doing, lads?
Suarez involved in all four goals for Barcelona, assisting three, scoring the other. Sevilla won 2-0 at Mallorca, keeping them in third place. In Germany, RB Leipzig end the year top after beating Augsburg 3-1. They moved 2 points further clear of Mönchengladbach, who drew 0-0 at Hertha Berlin. They are the first side from East Germany to ever be top of the Bundesliga during the winter break.
And they play Gladbach, I think, on the 1st of February, so relatively soon after the winter break.
But
I'm hoping to go to that, but we'll see.
Oh, I hope you do go.
Thanks.
Can I come?
Yeah, if you want. There's two Michelin-style restaurants in Leipzig that
I don't want to go. I don't like fine dining.
Really?
No interest in it. No, I just like a classic rustic Italian meal.
Really small portions, fine dining.
Yeah,
I'm not here for
it's
small portions.
A lot of foam and a lot of
value
jus
for money is
and
no.
A lot of bollocks, frankly.
Depends where you go. Like.
Bayern Munich are hot on their heels in third after beating Wolfsburg 2-0. Both goals for Munich came in the final 5 minutes of the game. They confirmed interim head coach Hans Flick will stay on until the end of the season, Lars.
Yeah, no, he's had a positive effect after he came in. They were unlikely to make any of the big hires they wanted to make mid-season, so why not? I mean, we were on stage in Leeds for this, but I think Hoffenheim coming back and turning it around against Dortmund is a little bit significant, because that's twice in a week where Dortmund have thrown away a perfectly good lead. And they've shown last couple of weeks they've some really good football they've played, but they're dropping points here and there. And like,
they're just massively fragile, aren't they? You just can't trust this Dortmund.
It's really weird, because they had a sort of slightly feckless and inexperienced backline with sort of Akanji, who's a good player but does weird things, Sagadu, who's still very young, and then in the summer they added Hummels, and the idea would be that Mats Hummels would come in and sort it all out, but they're still like. Any sign of pressure, and it just doesn't work at all.
Right, to Italy now. It's been a dramatic weekend. Here's Nicky Bandini.
2019 will end with Juventus and Inter joint top of the Serie A table after both won their final league games of the year. Cristiano Ronaldo's gravity-defying header got Juventus past Sampdoria on Wednesday, and Inter followed up by thumping Genoa 4-0 on Saturday. An especially lovely moment at the end of that game as Sebastiano Esposito, Inter's 17-year-old academy graduate striker, hugged his mum and had a little happy cry beside the pitch after becoming the youngest player ever to score for Inter at San Siro. It was a great final round for Roma as well. They beat Fiorentina 4-1 and Atalanta, who thrashed Milan 5-0. Less great for Fiorentina's manager Vincenzo Montella, who was fired afterwards, and for Milan, who are already on their second manager of the season. Zvonimir Boban, a four-time Serie A winner, of course, with Milan in the 90s and now the club's CFO, was left reassuring journalists at full-time that Stefano Pioli's job was still safe. But the biggest game in Italian football this weekend didn't take place in Italy at all, rather in Saudi Arabia, the latest country to host the increasingly nomadic Supercoppa between last season's league and cup winners. Those would be Juventus and Lazio, of course, who you might recall played each other in the league just 2 weeks ago. Lazio won 3-1 on that occasion, and they won 3-1 on this occasion as well, opening the scoring through Luis Alberto and continuing to play by far the more incisive and effective football, even after Paolo Dybala had pulled Juventus level on the stroke of half-time. Simone Inzaghi made all the right calls as manager of Lazio, sending on Marco Parolo for Luis Alberto in the second half, only for Parolo to make the flick on, from which Stanilic got them back in front before Danilo Cataldi sealed the win with a gorgeous free kick in injury time. Lazio are the only team besides Juventus to have won any major domestic silverware in Italy since 2014. They'd already won the Supercoppa once since then, and then the Coppa Italia last year, of course. But to do it this way, outplaying and beating Juventus 3-1 for the second time in 2 weeks, really feels like a statement. They are only 6 points off first in Serie A and have a game in hand to come in the new year. Juve's rule over Italian football does not look quite so certain at the end of 2019 as it has for most of the decade.
Thank you, Nicky. To France, PSG won their seventh league game in a row with a 4-1 win over Amiens at the Parc des Princes. Mbappe scored two. Marseille stays 7 points behind after they beat Nîmes 3-1 at home. Big result for Monaco. They thumped fourth place Lille 5-1 at the Stade Louis II. Tom Williams tweet. There will be no goal line technology in tonight's Nice-Toulouse game because rodents chewed through some electric cables. That is tremendous, isn't it? I'm with the rodents, frankly. If they could ship a load over here... Oh, we've got enough of our own, I guess. Don't need to be French rodents to chew through some cables and get rid of VAR.
It's gone weird, Max.
Jamie says... Max, usually you can do... This is a reaction to last week. Max, usually you can do no wrong in my eyes. Thanks, Jamie. But mentioning Eric Dier as having a small head. The lad has one of the biggest meat Swedes in the Premier League. It gets even bigger when he shaves it, if that makes sense. Another Jamie said, really small-headed footballers. My friend was best man at Peter Ramage's wedding. Behind both their backs, Peter we used... Ramage. Oh, so it brings back happy memories.
Yeah, he was quite good for QPR. Mm. Seemed like a nice guy.
In what year was Peter Ramage good?
I want to say probably 2008, 2010.
I have changed.
I would need to double check.
No,
don't
you? Don't, close to the Jamie Mackey era at QPR.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think you need to check.
The first era, though. He did have two eras.
I don't think anyone will care. I had Peter Ramage back in like the 80s. Anyway, behind both their backs, we used to refer to Rammy as P-Head to Ramage in the somewhat clumsy reference to his miniature and circular cranium. Jose says, if Guardian Football Weekly decided to make a movie, I would put Simon Pegg as Max and Nick Frost as Barry as the obvious starting pair. I'll leave it to you to decide the rest of the cast. Obviously, the robot from Short Circuit for Jonathan Wilson.
You're presumably, I see you fuming, you're not getting Affleck.
I don't mind that. Obviously, Lars is either evil Tory spin doctor Nick Timothy, or the games teacher from Grange Hill, or the small kid from The Sixth Sense. Google it. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, that's the last one there is depressingly accurate.
Well done to Grant Holt for being in Panto as well. That was nice over the weekend. And Michael says, what Christmas detective TV show is Jonathan Wilson looking forward to this Christmas?
Well, The Plan on Christmas Day is actually going back to a classic, and I guess it's not a detective show, but to watch the 1981 BBC version of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. So,
ooh, very good.
Go for one in the morning, have my Christmas lunch at a pub, and then come back and I think I might have some more of this red. I think I've got another five bottles.
That's really good. Well, listen, that'll do for today. It feels like I've just watched The Irishman, the film, and it's taken me 4 days and I've not finished it on Netflix, so I feel like this pod might take you... Well, you've got time, haven't you? You've got a lot of time with your family. This will at least give you 3 one-hour sections to get away from everyone that you have to pretend to like but you won't like and listen to us instead. Thank you so much for listening to us all this year. Oh, hang on, we've got another one when I can do that. Emotional thanks for 2019. I'll do that on the 27th. Flo, thanks.
Thanks, Max.
Two thumbs up is a good way of saying thanks on this. Jonathan, thank you.
I will see you on the 27th.
Lars, you may finish the pod making whatever noise you feel is appropriate.
That makes no sense because no one knows that you've forced them to edit out the bird's noise that the people wanted. There were many tweets.
Here you go.
There's several tweets.
Anyone who's still...
Do you know what annoys me is you're really shit at doing bird noises.
We'll be back. We'll be back on the 26th.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.